41st Marion Thompson Wright Lecture Series is set for Saturday, February 20th, presented by the Clement A. Price Institute on Ethnicity, Culture, and the Modern Experience. This year's theme is One Begins Again. This time it will be a virtual conference, and you can register right away by going to ethnicity.rutgers.edu. The conference will be via Zoom. That's what we're doing today here on the WBGO Journal, talking about this major annual event. And joining us is the director of the Institute. Back with us is historian, curator, writer, and professor Jack Chen. We'll never forget Dr. Price, and we'll be talking about that today because we have two of the original members of the Marion Thompson Wright Study Club and longtime friends. In fact, Leonard Mews was a friend from childhood. Leonard Mews joins us. He's the former director of planning for the city of Petersburg, Virginia, and was awarded a Master of City and Regional Planning degrees from Rutgers and has worked in several administrations. And Larry Green joins us, also a close friend of Clement Price, professor of history at Seton Hall University. And Professor Green is still going strong, authoring more than 20 articles and chapters in books, journals, and encyclopedias on topics from the New Jersey African-American history to Langston Hughes and the African-American press. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us on the WBGO Journal.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me.
Pleasure to have all of you aboard here as we talk about the 41st Marion Thompson Wright Lecture Series. Professor Chen, I want to talk to you first because this year is all virtual. So you've had to adjust your schedule, adjust how things are going. And was this more of a challenge or an opportunity to get even more people involved? And maybe this year, even more people looking at the MTW.
Well, there's nothing to replace an in-person gathering. It's been an annual ritual that has been going on for 41 years. And people get dressed up special. We spend the whole day together. People eat together and there's beautiful music and also listen to great talk. So we miss that. We miss getting together. But you're absolutely right. With it being virtual, we have a chance of going over the capacity of that room that we're usually in, which is about 400, 450 people. So this year we hope to double that number and to get to people around the country in a way that we haven't been able to. And thanks for mentioning the title of the conference, One Begins Again. The subtitle would be Organizing and the Historical Imagination, and really is about this moment that we're in of COVID, but also a moment in which we're seeing the deep historical injustices that have continued to ramify and resonate our society because of those issues. So we're really trying to hit that both in terms of how the past constitutes the present, the crisis we're in terms of the present, and then also what we can begin to imagine in terms of rebuilding a future.
Professor Green and Professor Chen, I would imagine that some interesting conversations are being held with your students during this time. Jack, if you could put up the poster of the Marion Thompson Wright Lecture Series, because that was actually put together. It's the artwork of Luis Reyes, who is a student. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Yeah, well, Luis is one of our many amazing students who is in the Arts, Media, and Culture program at Rutgers at Newark. And we were looking around for someone who could capture what it means to be organizing and what this moment is, and kind of a sense of the history of the Black Power Fist, but also a sense of the dynamism of how that meaning of that gesture is morphing as we speak. So we wanted to kind of pay our respects to that moment and also update it a little bit. So we've got some gold foil on the poster, makes it very distinctive. And we're really proud of it because we would meet with him, he'd be getting the idea, and we'd met with him a few more times and he tweaked it to the point that we're very happy. People will be able to get a copy of the poster and the postcard, which we designed as a keepsake. So if people are interested in one, just let us know and we'll get you a copy of it. But we're very proud. These are frameable kinds of posters.
Leonard Mews, I would imagine that you are so proud of what has taken place with the Marion Thompson Wright Lecture Series, being a childhood friend of Dr. Price and Giles Wright, putting this together all those years ago. Did you have any idea that it could reach this magnitude?
Yes, very proud. Not an idea about the magnitude, but certainly a confidence over the years in Clement and in Giles, who were determined that, yes, this is going to be scholarship, et cetera, but were determined that it would be a premier academic, not just a premier academic event, but a premier conference and a premier expression of public history and public intellectualism.
Leonard, I have to ask you, when the funeral was held for Dr. Price, everybody in the audience felt that he was their best friend, and because that's how he made you feel. You were his childhood friend from all those years ago. What can you tell us about when he was growing up that maybe we didn't know, that he would become this powerful figure in New Jersey to a point where everybody loved him and considered him their best friend?
Difficult to explain. Not so difficult to fathom as we both kind of grew along the way, but his brother and I from time to time laugh about a point in time around high school when we both when we conversed, we know Clement was trying to become a thug. He was kind of losing his way, if you will, and his father, a very nice man, but a very determined man, was determined that Clement was going to change his ways. And I certainly won't bore you or maybe excite you with the details of what he did. Nothing so very bad. Mm-hmm. But he kind of wanted to be a street guy in some respects. And at some point, following high school, when he and I, he was 2 years ahead of me, and we had determined he was going to St. Augustine's College. He enrolled in St. Augustine's College his freshman year. That would have been 1963, the fall of 1963, and I would follow in 2 years. But he had a moment. At St. Augustine's College, I don't know the truly what inspired him beyond a history professor whom I had, a guy named Dr. Elmer Schwartzman. And he somehow saw something in Clement and inspired him to say, look, maybe you need to change venues. And after Clement's freshman year, he left St. Aug and went to the University of Bridgeport. And from that point, it clearly became clear that his history would be a major part of his life, and that he would be someone to be recognized and reckoned with. Now, we certainly at that point, we didn't imagine the levels, but he had made that determination and clearly had decided he was not going to be a street guy. He was going to be he was bent on being an academician. And we kind of fell apart was a few years until I graduated from St. Augustine's College in 1969. And in 1971, I married. And married a woman I met in college, and she's downstairs as we speak. She had a teaching job in Newark, in the midst of one of the most difficult strikes of teachers in the nation. And she, a Southern girl, wanting to work, had just graduated in 1970, got a teaching position in the Newark Public School System, which that's a whole nother story. But we got married in 1971, moved to Newark. When it became known within the family that I'd moved to Newark, Mrs. Price called me, Clement's mother. We got in touch with one another, and she said, "Oh, you know, Clement's up in New Jersey. He's in Essex County, blah, blah, blah." And his family, our families were friends. And she said, "You got to go, you know, here's his number, find him." And at that point, we found one another again, and another part of our life journey and friendship began with Clement being on the scene when we went to see The Godfather in New York on the East Side when it premiered. There were four of us, me, Clement, a woman named Linda Parks, and my then young wife. And Rose had a car. She had a Camaro that her father gave her for graduation, and it was stolen. Oh. So we had this adventure of getting back to Newark from New York. There are a lot of stories. But Clement and I just began again, not taking from Jack, and we began again, and I entered Rutgers in 1972. So we were both had another part of our friendship where things coalesced, that I was studying again, and Clement was at that time, I think, had earned his doctorate and had started his teaching at Rutgers. It's just been a long and wonderful journey. It was very sad to get a call from Mary Sue when Clement passed, and to know the immediate circumstances that he was doing commentary and being part of a Jewish film festival that was going on in New Brunswick. And there are a lot of kind of backstories of how and why, but we had maintained a relationship for all these years. He is the godfather of our first son, Adisa. And Clement and I rode around on one occasion. I can tell you exactly where I was on March the 3rd, 1975. I was riding around with Clement in an old raggedy Plymouth, riding around Plainfield, awaiting the birth of my son at Muhlenberg Hospital. And we've just been friends and more, and he has been an inspiring person to watch his rise, not just as a historian, but as a really good man.
Well, you certainly picked quite a friend there, Leonard. Professor Green, these are really amazing times that students and the rest of the world are going through right now. So as we approach the MTW this time around, what have you been hearing from students at Seton Hall? What have you been hearing from people in your class talking about the whole idea of, you know, this one begins again, and we can do better, and we have to do better? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, certainly the events of the last 4 years have been very, very important to our students. It has reinvigorated their interest in politics and society. Certainly the Black Lives Matter movement has brought police brutality to the forefront. Issues of voter suppression, the Black voter suppression, has, of course, reinvigorated student activism in places. You can see the Black students once again playing a major part in social activism. And, of course, the most recent insurrection at the White House, at the Capitol building. All of that has provided a source of interest in history, in my African-American history class, in my American history class, for example. Today, I just talked about Reconstruction. And the tie-in is that we are perhaps moving into the third Reconstruction. The first Reconstruction after the Civil War, which passed what is called the Civil War Amendments, ending the 13th Amendment, ending slavery, the 14th Amendment, providing blacks with citizenships, the 15th Amendment with the right to vote. But that Reconstruction was overturned. So within 35 years, by the time we get to the turn of the century, ethnic cleansing has occurred in the South in terms of voter registration rolls. Blacks are off the voter registration rolls. Those blacks elected to state legislatures and even to the U.S. Congress, two blacks in the U.S. Senate, all of that is gone in 30 years after the Civil War. Lynching has become very pronounced in the American South. So we see with Reconstruction, we have a counter-Reconstruction. The failure of Reconstruction that I was talking about today is what led to the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s, which historians call the Second Reconstruction. And then eventually we get the pushback from that in terms of the Reagan administration and the Republican Party becoming a party sort of infused with the old Southern Democrats and what was known as Dixiecrats. And they have been pushing back against the Civil Rights Bill and the voting, particularly the Voting Rights Bill of 1965. And certainly the Trump administration is there pushing back and relying on voter suppression in the South for their political strategy and electing Republicans in the Southern states and some even in the Northern states. So we're in an interesting time. We see groups like the Proud Boys, the Oath Takers, neo-Nazis, the Klan. Well, today I was just talking about the Klan, the White Shirts, the White Leagues, the Red Shirts rather, and the White Leagues, the Knights of the White Camellia, and so forth, were paramilitary outfits of ex-Confederate soldiers that were involved in voter suppression and violence in the South. So in a way, we see change, which is good, but we also see continuity and change, which is negative. So this leads us to look at something that Carol Anderson, in her book called White Rage, talking about the divide in the American nation, the racial divide. It's been a persistent problem. My students see that in their history, and they're reading a different type of history. Academic history is very different from what transpires in many public schools. Much of history in many public schools has been sanitized, not in college-level history texts, but in many public school texts. Therefore, when our students come to college, they come across a very different American history, where race, racial struggle, racism, classism, sexism have been constant threads in American history. And so this motivates a lot of our students and opens their eyes to take a close look at how that history has shaped our present. And that's what we're doing. And I think the role of Marion Thompson Wright lecture series is that we have always been on top of the new changes and the new directions in American history and bringing that revisionism, that progressive and positive revisionism to the general public. And I think that has been a consistent theme in our approach to the Marion Thompson Wright series, to educate the public about the new changes in research in our history that shows both the positive and negative aspects of that history.
Jack, if I can call you that, Professor Chen, as we look at this this powerful lineup that you have and talking about Black organizers, the vision of organizers, tell us about some of the aspects that you want to highlight with this year's virtual conference.
We wanted to trace the lineage of Black organizers throughout U.S. history from the very, very beginning, and how really it's been Black organizers who have kind of reimagined and reconstituted what America can be and wasn't yet. And this goes from the very beginning, in which as Bill Fletcher Jr., who's one of our speakers, is writing about, and looking at the very first labor movement in this country as not the emergence of the white industrial labor movement, but in fact, the emergence of those who are indentured and those enslaved, even during the colonial period and moving into the formation of the United States with the revolutionary kind of founding fathers and mothers, right? So that automatically shakes up what the founding history is about. And it's really premised on the idea of settler colonialism, in which the dispossession of Native peoples who are still in the state and still around, but largely marginalized, pushed to the side, the Munsee Lenape, for example, the dispossession of their lands and how that was replaced with the plantations, the Hackensack Plantation, for example, that brought in enslaved peoples. So there's a reworking of the historical framing, but also necessarily a rethinking about even what this pandemic moment in the present is about. So Kara Page is a longtime organizer, memory worker, queer feminist scholar, who is really looking at the medical industrial complex and how the unresolved issues of disparities and injustice with how medicine and wellness is organized in this society is part of the deep problem that hasn't been addressed. And so she's taking that on at a moment in which we're seeing it, I think, very clearly what the disparities are. And then I'm really happy to say that we have Alicia Garza, who is one of the co-founders of the hashtag Black Lives Matter movement and the movement for Black futures, for example. And her focus is really on precisely what Larry was talking about, this third reconstruction, and how can we keep that reconstruction window open and start making the changes that have to be made, learning from the past limits of the past two reconstructions, and how can we move even further in reimagining what American society can be. And I'm really happy to say that the three of them will be joining with Barbara Ransby, who's the historian, distinguished historian at the University of Illinois Chicago campus, in examining really how these different moments of the Black organizing movement constitute a reimagining of the entire vision of what America and the United States can be. So we're really excited by this grouping we have this year.
How has the marketing gone for this year's conference? It has to be different because about it being virtual, anybody in the world can be participating.
We're getting the word out. It's wonderful being in Newark causing a parking jam, on MTW day on Saturday. But we're just sending it out to all of the networks that we're connected to. And I have to say, I think there's a global moment, as we know, that with the impact of the pandemic everywhere, and also the impact of Black Lives Matter everywhere, that there's a lot of interest across the country, but also internationally.
Leonard, I wanted to ask you, what are your thoughts about what's been going on in the country very briefly, and how you tie this into the Marion Thompson Wright Lecture Series?
A couple of things. If I can get back to a point that Larry spoke to, that part of what the lecture series had come to do was to give an award to a teacher of Black history in New Jersey, every year at the grade school level, so that it didn't just manifest itself. The teaching of Black history wouldn't manifest itself in college, if you will, but also Clement in his vision and through the Institute got into the earlier ages of learning and in the public system. Coming from working in local government, one in a place like Petersburg, which is a very Black city, 80% Black population, there's the presence of African Americans in the positions of leadership. And I think at this point in the nation, one thing that I am seeing is having lived through the times, the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, more young Black folk in public service. That is encouraging to me. We see it in the Congress. We're seeing it in the Virginia State House. How I got to Virginia, well, because my wife is from Virginia and we moved back home, so to speak. It's been a very interesting journey for me to see Virginia come to be this blue state. Clement and I grew up in Washington, D.C., and it could be very dangerous to go across the Potomac River into Virginia when we were younger men, go to Arlington or somewhere like that, and you certainly don't go to Fairfax. Could be very dangerous for Black folk. And it brings to mind that the headquarters of the American Nazi Party, when we were younger men, was in either Arlington or Fairfax, Virginia. This guy, Lincoln Rockwell, was the leader of the party. So you could go right across the bridge, the 14th Street Bridge, into Virginia, and you were in Nazi land. So we fortunately seen a lot of change. Not nearly enough. I think about my time as being in high school and college and some of the same arguments that were being made then are being made now for inclusion, for the how to get beyond the racism of America. And it's something that we talked about with Jack as he approached us early on about the lecture. Baldwin's notion that until America comes to terms with the lie that it has put in place for all these many years, you'll see some changes on the surface, but at the heart, the lie is still in place.
Larry, can you tell us the importance for everyone to be able to check out the 41st Annual Marion Thompson Wright Lecture Conference?
I think one of the importances it ties our history, the history of America, the history of African American history and race in U.S. history, into the present. And it raises the question, where do we go from here? If I can take a title from Martin Luther King's book of many years ago, where do we go from here, chaos or community? That idea is still very relevant today. And what the participants will indicate tomorrow is a discussion on what is our path forward toward the realization of a more egalitarian society, a more just society. Where do we go? What is our roadmap? How do we approach that now? That at least for the moment, the neo-fascist elements in the United States seem to have at least temporarily been thwarted. Well, how and where do we go forward to achieve a more just society, a more democratic society?
Jack, the Institute has saw all this happening. So I would imagine that there's been tremendous discussion that's been going on, not only with staffers, but with the students and people who are around at the center. What do you want to tell us about how it's changed you, how it's changed the Institute?
Well, the Institute has been strong from the very beginning because it embodied Clement's deep understanding of history and his drive to make sure that this would be public. So he would give his tours around Newark and kind of talk about really the meaning of different places and what happened in different places. So that past is not so distant. And we're carrying on that in that tradition. We're doubling down on mapping and using technology to show how these stories can be embedded. The same place can have many, many layers and facets of stories of the same of the people who had been there. And it's very easy to kind of lose track of what had been there. For example, when the campus was created, that was a Black and Latinx community that had been there. And once they kind of bulldozed that out, then of course the memories of those communities, of that community, including the historic African American community with some of the key churches and families that had been there for a long time, that history risks being disappeared. So recently on our campus, we renamed the soccer field after Frederick Douglass, who did speak at a church there. And we're documenting the history. One of our fantastic students who's been working at the New York Public Library, Noelle Williams, has been documenting the history of that King family, for example. And we're going to be showing that on a digital map that you can look at on your phone as you're walking around. So in some ways we're trying to update what's going on, but also bring in more people so that even in the classroom, as they're researching somebody, they can begin to understand that they can also be authoring bits and pieces of historical perspective and entering into these maps themselves and contributing to the larger story. So we're really trying to bring in more people to be researchers and also to also include the indigenous history of Lenape folks who really were there way before everybody else. And then when Robert Treat and his Connecticut Puritans arrived and they're allowed to use the land, not to settle the land, we have to put that into perspective as well, that downtown Newark, as we think of it today, was actually indigenous Three Sisters, Maysfields originally. And it was never meant to be the permanent possession of the Puritans themselves. So those histories of displacement, of housing issues, of who's there, who's displaced, how health is thought about, wellness is thought about, all those kinds of questions are kind of still living today because they're unresolved from that early time period.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the 41st Marion Thompson Wright Lecture Series that is set for Saturday, February 20th, presented by the Clement A. Price Institute on Ethnicity, Culture, and the Modern Experience. And this year's theme is One Begins Again, and the conference can be watched via Zoom. You can register by going to ethnicity.rutgers.edu. Recently had a conversation and was listening to more about the PBS documentary, The Black Church, and they talked about how Rosetta Tharpe is one of the people that a lot of people don't talk enough about her influence when it comes to music and the Black Church. I want to talk about Marion Thompson Wright. And I want to feel, Leonard, you and Larry were both there as part of the original MTW Study Club. What should we know more about Marion Thompson Wright that we don't know, Leonard?
What I've learned of Marion Thompson Wright, I've learned from Clement and then picked up from that. She has the distinction, I think, of being the first female, Black female PhD in New Jersey. And she was a dedicated scholar, and that became her life for some very good reasons and for some very troubling reasons. She kind of lost a lot in terms of a family in her pursuit of scholarship. I have recently, in the past few years, met a gentleman here in Petersburg who is a retired physics professor who was at, he was a graduate student at Howard while Dr. Wright was teaching. And he recalls times when he was at the same rooming house where Dr. Wright and several other teachers at Howard lived, and his recounting is just like, you know, a group of me, you, and somebody else coming. They would come together in the evenings and drink and play cards and that kind of thing. Sometimes we put folks on well-deserved pedestals, and you tend to not realize she was a wonderful woman, and an enormous scholar who I don't know exactly why Clement had derived such inspiration from her. But it's clearly evident that he did in naming things after her. And I think a lot of it had to do also with his ongoing relationship with Giles, as they would essentially challenge each other to uncover the next thing, the next thought. The other part I think that the influence of Marion Thompson Wright on Clement, it seems to have influenced him to be also Clement was a wonderful mentor to other aspiring scholars. And as you look at the list of those who have presented, some were his students or other scholars that he learned from and had a large influence on them. For me, the Marion Thompson Wright lecture is a whole lot more than just the third Saturday in February when it occurs. It is this, it is its own institution, if you will, that has taken on this great and important life. And such an important life in Newark that Jack talked about. You asked Jack how he was marketing it in this virtual time prior to the pandemic. The lecture kind of almost marketed itself. Many anticipated the next lecture. And as I would regularly attend from the late 80s forward, you would see the same and growing audience. It'd be a reunion with some friends for me,
as
well as the children of people began to come to the lecture. So it's more than just a Saturday.
Larry, too, when you think about your relationship with Clement and started on a scholarly basis, but I think it also says something that 41 years ago, a conference was named for a woman. Mm-hmm. I think when we think about that, the power and kind of, you know, the whole thought process that was going through Giles and Clement and thinking about, hey, let's honor this special lady. Almost unheard of at that time, right, Larry?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And one of the things, since Giles, Clem, and I were all involved in New Jersey African American history, we all came across her work, her articles that appeared in the Journal of Negro History and in other places, New Jersey History, the Proceedings of New Jersey Historical Society. So we came across her work, and her work was foundational to our work. For example, Clem was working, his dissertation was on Newark, the history of Newark. Well, Marion Thompson Wright wrote about Black history in New Jersey for her doctoral dissertation at Columbia University, you know, my actual alma mater. My first publication was for a seminar with a distinguished historian, Eric Foner. And that paper was published in the Proceedings of New Jersey History, Emancipation Proclamation in New Jersey, in the Paranoid Style. I relied on some of her articles that she had written. And of course, Giles was the specialist in African-American history for the New Jersey Historical Commission. So all three of us had come across in our own work, Marion Thompson Wright. You know, in other words, we footnoted her. Yeah. And so she was a pioneer, as Leonard has pointed out, one of the first Black PhD women in America, and certainly in the state. So she was a legitimate pioneer, and that was unusual for a woman in those days of any color. There were very few women historians, white or Black, that were there in the time that Marion Thompson Wright was researching. And so we felt that it was, who better to name a conference after than someone who had given so much of her life to New Jersey history and the study of New Jersey history and the study of African American history. And of course, we were very happy that we did do that, because now we can see that not only is African American history front and center now in academic narratives of the American experience, so was women. And so Marion Thompson Wright was at, in a sense, at that crossroads.
Jack, people that are already now maybe have never attended the MTW, what can they do, and what else would you like to tell us about the conference that we haven't talked about?
Well, it's this year, as I said earlier, it's a whole day event, but this time, because it's online, we've compressed it into 3.5 hours. So beginning at 9:30, we will have a blessing from the chief of the Turtle Clan of the Munsee Lenape peoples, Chief Vincent Mann. And then we also will have our campus choir sing, Lift Every Voice and Sing, virtually. And we will have the mayor with an especially impassioned welcome to the event. We will have also, of course, our Chancellor Nancy Cantor speaking. And for the first time, we will have Jonathan Holloway, who is a noted African-American historian in his own right. He had been at Northwestern, who is the president of the now Rutgers University system. And he'll be speaking not so much as the president, but he'll be speaking as a historian, helping to frame this event and this focus on organizing and the historical imagination. I'm really also happy to say that Reverend Lennox Yearwood, who's the chair of the Hip Hop Caucus, they focus especially on climate change issues. He will be giving a talk about the cross-generational questions of organizing itself. And also we have the award of the Giles Wright Award that Larry will be giving to a very deserving organization. And then also Newark's own poet, PhD, Helena Lewis will be composing a poem just for this event. We're really excited that she's doing that. And Dean Jackie Mattis, who joins us now from Michigan, she's our new Dean of Arts and Sciences. She and I will be closing out the event. So there's going to be poetry, there's going to be music, there's going to be lots of engaged talk and lots of powerful speech. So we think it's going to be a very quick event, but very impactful and very meaningful. And it will be taped, so people will be able to share it as well.
That's fantastic. I, before we started this part of the interview, Larry had shown me some of the books he has behind him. I want to go to you, Jack. You have all kinds of, it looks like tapes and books. What's the one behind you that means the most to you or connects most to Marion Thompson, right?
Well, you know, I have to say that Barbara Ransby, who's been writing about Black women organizers and activists, is the one who most connects directly, I think, to Marion Thompson Wright. So it's really, take a look at any of her books over the past few years. She's also become the historian of Black Lives Matter as well. So I would commend any book that she's written because she conveys a powerful sense of what especially the Black women's involvement in organizing broad movements that change the United States. She's a terrific writer.
Well, first, let me congratulate both Leonard and Larry as being, you know, original members of the Marion Thompson Wright Study Club, because, gentlemen, you have put together something very special for New Jersey and especially here in Newark, and Jack can certainly attest to that. And I've always said that it was in 1998, the first person to greet me in Newark was Dr. Price. And he means a great deal to me and think about him often. In fact, right here on my desk, I still have the picture of him that I look at quite often, because he has meant so much to me here in Newark as the news director for WBGO. So congratulations in advance on this another terrific 41st version of the Marion Thompson Wright Lecture Series. And I thank all of you for joining us on the WBGO Journal.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for all your work.
Thank you for having me.